Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassam. Very special time for us at the monastery, obviously. Lompo Sumedho was with us with Ajahn Asoku, and then Ajahn Khemasiri will be here for the Vassa. He's just resting. Some of you have met him. Venerable Indapanya has joined us from lands afar. So tomorrow is the day where we determine as a Sangha to live in what we call a rains residence. This is an annual occurrence where the monks and novices determined to stay in one monastic residence for the 3 months of the what would correspond to the rainy season in Asia, India, Thailand. And that's a tradition which we are asked to observe by our Vinaya, by our Vinaya rules. And so Ajahn Khemasiri arrived just in time, Venerable Indapanya. So we have a very auspicious Sangha. We'd like to keep Lompo for the 3 months, but we have an allowance where we're allowed to enter what we call the second Vassa, which would be after the day after the full moon of August. So we have a kind of, that's part of our rule, our monastic rule. So unfortunately, Lompo will be leaving 4th or 3rd of August, but we're very fortunate to have him. And he's been very, very generous. He offered us teaching today and this morning. So I'm over the moon. And because he's both my teacher and a very good friend, and we've suffered a lot together and gained wisdom. Ajahn Sumedho really molded my practice. I think Ajahn Chah inspired me as a human being. I can't imagine anyone more perfected than Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Sumedho really molded my practice because I didn't speak very good Thai. And although I could get the feeling for it, Ajahn Sumedho always offered me very clear guidance in my own predicament and my own interpretations of Four Noble Truths and how to apply that. So I'm very much his disciple and very much in his debt. So today is Asala Puja, and so it's the month of Asala in the Pali tradition, and the full moon of July traditionally celebrates the first teaching of the Buddha, Dhammacakka Sutta, which you chanted. And we have these yearly cycles. Each year we have the same days of observance and celebration, Asala Puja, Vaisak, Katina, Magha Puja. So it's a very steady calendar. Every year, the same thing. We have the same precept ceremony every full moon, every new moon. Those who are resident in the monastery undertake to keep the 8 precepts of formal recitation. We as a Bhikkhu Sangha and the Samana Sangha in general, we recollect the Patimokkha, so Venerable Amarasiri chanted that today. Every fortnight. So there's nothing new. This has been going on for 2,500 years. And it's not a matter of fashion. It's not a fad. It's not a matter of political agendas. It's not a matter of identity politics. You know, all the different things that move contemporary society, we're affected by it, but we move to our own rhythm, and this rhythm is very important because it creates a kind of stability. It creates, I think, for all of us who are involved in this life, it creates a kind of social stability, social cohesion that we all understand. This is what we do. This is what monks do. This is what lay people do. This is how we live together. These are observances. So we're not always trying to invent something exciting or interesting. So you might think, well, that's pretty boring. It's same old, same old. But actually, It's rare in the world where you have, I think, such social stability. Very quite rare. And in a way which isn't forced. It's not, you're not forced to come here. You're not forced to keep the eight precepts. It's not done from fear. It's done from respect. It's done from a sense of veneration. And because we're all involved in that, although we are monks and we keep a different rule, the lay people keep the same rule in general. We have the same aspiration. We have the same kind of moral boundaries, and socially we understand how to relate to each other. And that social stability is obviously very, very helpful, because what we're trying to contemplate is that which is beyond social conventions. We're trying to understand a possibility in the human heart which is truly free. And no social convention can free you. But without social conventions, you can just be involved in trying to get them right. So all the issues around identity politics now and so on and so forth, very difficult, very, very difficult. So I identify as a bhikkhu. And it's quite simple. And I know my rule. I know my relationships to the laity, even in a culture that is 2,500 years after the Buddha. And that identity isn't an ego identity. I am a bhikkhu and you're a lay person. A normal, you're a lay person over there, right? It's not conceited. It's not based upon I'm better than you. It's based upon a surrender to a way of being, to a way of living, to a way of relating. So I didn't invent it, Lhapa Samhita didn't invent it, Lhapa Cha didn't invent it. Comes to us in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha and the monks there created this form. And that's very, very important, because we can all give up to it. We'll have some differences of opinion about nuances of the rules, but basically we can all give up to it. And if someone doesn't give up to it, we say, yeah, it's okay, go away. I don't mind. So we don't have to accommodate everyone's viewpoints about whatever you want. We say, no, this is what we do. We do this. We do monk, we do layperson, we do eight precepts. And so through this kind of voluntary surrender to this form, we don't have to keep recreating who's going to be senior, or all the different arguments you might have. No, this is the way we function. So that social stability gives us the freedom to look at greed, hatred, delusion, to look at suffering as an existential problem, rather than thinking by changing the monastery or changing the Vinaya or changing the diet or listening to Grateful Dead, somehow, we can solve our problems. So it's interesting, monastic life kind of binds you into a form, but then that binding, which is yoga, is about you're bound to something, you're bound to the form, but within that you have the freedom to watch and to observe, and the freedom to leave. It's like monks don't ordain for a lifetime, they ordain for the training. Some of us are lifers and some are not. But so there's a freedom, always a freedom. So then within that, we have a chance to contemplate the Dhammacakkhasutta, the Four Noble Truths. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't really have the whole Buddhasasana, because the Buddhasasana includes Dhamma Vinaya, includes a social construct and a social equations that we live within, social forms that we live within. And then within that, we can contemplate the Four Noble Truths. Now, I was contemplating a lot the word practice. That's a word you hear a lot. I want to do my practice. And to be honest, I've never liked the word. It's just a word. But I found sometimes, people will say, leave me alone, I'm doing my practice. You guys do the dishes, I'm doing my practice. I want a better place to practice. There's too much work here, I want to go where there's practice. You guys study too much, I want to go practice. The monks are too tall, I want to practice with short monks. All kinds of things can come up. So the very idea of practice, I don't know how you interpret that, but it can sound like, for me, that word is a very mechanical word. So I, when I was trying to learn how to play basketball, I had to learn how to dribble with my left hand. Bounce, 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 bounce. So that I could, you know, I could play basketball, practice. Or music or whatever. But there's something about that, again, it's just a word, you know, and language is what it is. But there's something about that word that to me has a kind of mechanical deadness. Whereas the language which I find inspiring from Ajahn Chah and Lopa Sumedho, investigation, experimentation, reflection, inquiry, what's it about? Try this, try that, right? And that sense of brightening the mind with a question, as Lompo was saying, in the talk after the Patimokkha, to me is a very important part of my own sense of the awakened mind. So I've been like contemplating, I've been talking about this for the last half year, but just making an experiment for myself of of looking at consciousness and bringing up the thought, is this, am I sitting here, you know, I've talked about it a lot, those of you have been here, but am I sitting here and you sitting there, or is the perception of people in awareness? Is awareness here and you are out there, or is out there in awareness? So that's an experiment I do. I ask myself, okay, what if I were to take that percent, like as my voice gives me a lot of problems, so I was just listening to the chanting, nice chanting and so on, so I could qualify, well, that's nice chanting, or it's off tone, or whatever, and just get caught in the quality of the experience. Or I could also say, well, this, to take the perception that this experience, am I hearing the sound out there, or is out there something in awareness? So I bring up a perception, a question, an experiment. I bring up an experiment that this experience is in awareness. And then I hold that as a question, as an experiment. And what happens if I do that? Now that, to me, doesn't seem like practice. That, to me, it's like exploration. I find it much, much more interesting. Rather than practicing to be aware, sometimes to be mindful, you know. When I started, that's what I tried to do. I tried to walk and not think. Counted my steps, I counted how many spoons of food I ate, and I hated it. I said, I don't want to live like this. Just controlling and forcing and so on. So Lompo said, that's not the way you do it. Inquire. And the inquiry, the kind of basic inquiry with it, which we are encouraged to do, is around suffering, discontent, fear, resentment, boredom, not wanting to be here, wanting to be somewhere else, not wanting to be these monks, wanting to be the other monks, pain, sickness, all these different things that are quite natural to the human condition. Now, when we inquire around, like, can you really practice the Four Noble Truths? Or do you use it as an invocation, as an investigation, as a consideration? I mean, I don't practice awareness of suffering. I inquire. Huh? To me, that seems a much more appropriate kind of language. Because when I suffer, then there's something is knocking on my brain, saying, "Hey, have a look, pay attention. What's going on here?" Now, if I don't pay attention, I just practice something, watching my breath or whatever, to get rid of the suffering or to distract it, then there cannot be any understanding. It can just be some kind of habitual running away from or blaming or whatever. But to actually inquire into the feeling of discontent, resentment, discomfort, heat. You know, like it's really hot in this room, right? Thank goodness for one fan. Now in the other building, it's freezing. So we go from... sorry, I got a cough. We go from freezing to hot. So I go in there, it's too cold. I come here, it's too hot. Can't win. But I can inquire into the feeling it's too hot, having done everything I can, put on the fan. It's at maximum speed, right? I could leave the room. Or I could take the feeling of discontent, such as heat, and say, okay, what does it feel like, heat? What does that feel like? And that's inquiry. I'm not looking for an answer. Heat feels like A, B, C, D. No, that's not it. It's I'm trying to become awake to the feeling of, it's not really suffering, but the feeling of discontent maybe that comes from heat. And now that to me is not a practice, it's an inquiry. It's an investigation. Now I might not be awake enough to do that. I might just feel hot. Oh, it's too hot. It's too hot. Bloody Ontario. We're going to build a Dharma hall. I can't take this anymore. That's not investigation. That's suffering. And quite often, we're not investigating suffering. We're just in it. Moan, grin, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that's the mind which isn't awake. And then we might just force our minds on the breath. Okay, I'm watching the breath now. And then we just get lost. But the inquiry or the awakening to heat or cold or whatever it is a brightening of the mind, isn't it? What's it like? What's it like to be really, really hot and uncomfortable? Now, what does that do? What does that do? Well, that puts you in the mode of non-grasping. And it's bringing you to the unconditioned, because now you're no longer reacting to suffering through desire. And what is desire doing? Desire is always trying to change the object, isn't it? The objects of experience, the objects of sound, the objects of memory, the objects of emotion. Desire is that which is caught up in those and always trying to get it right. Change this one to get another one. And that works, yeah, to a certain extent. You can certainly leave this room and go to a cooler place. You can certainly do some things to leave it. You can eat food if you're hungry. You can, if you cut yourself, you can put a Band-Aid on it, or if you've got a cough, you can get a chest x-ray. You can do all of that. And you have to do that. And I'm not saying you don't do that, right? But what is the dimension that the Buddha is pointing to that isn't just about rearranging the objective world? What is that dimension? And that's why we come to this life. The Anagarikas will be taking the Papacha ordination on Saturday morning, and their ordination chant is, we're doing this for the realization of Nibbana. Not for comfort, not for food, not for you know, some super duper ajahn who can just whap, you know, I wish I could, whack. They're enlightened. They're not doing that. They're doing it for their own enlightenment, Nibbana. Now that's not selfish. And one of the things people misunderstand is they think that liberation is somehow mutually exclusive from social activism. It's not. Who could be more socially wisely engaged in a free person? Huh? Who has the most freedom to respond with wisdom than an enlightened being? Lompa Cha. I mean, he was right in the middle of all kinds of social controversy and complexity and hundreds of monks around him, and his answers were always spot on. His responses were spot on. Because freedom is not devoid, it's not separate from our social, the way we engage socially. We have no choice. We have to engage socially because we're social beings. It's not mutually exclusive. So that idea sometimes that you have that, yeah, meditation is that compartment, I do retreats, and I sit on my cushion, there's the rest of life. That's a fallacy. That's the fallacy of control and sense deprivation. Sure, go on a retreat, no sense stimulation, you know, if someone cooks for you, you have to pay a bit of money, okay. And there's one guy that talks all the time, fine, I don't have to talk, blah, I feel peaceful. That's not liberation, it's sense deprivation, that's all it is. It's just another experience. Huh? And then you leave that and you go into the hurly-burly, oh, I want to go back to the retreat. Well, sure you do, because we don't like suffering. We don't like complexity and all the rest of it. But come here and try to do that for a year. You know, we won't let you actually, you'll have to cook. But go somewhere for a year, right? With nothing to do. You'll go bananas in 2 weeks. It'll be very, very difficult, actually, because of desire. So rather than see freedom as sense deprivation, as some kind of quietism away from life and all of that, you see it more as the awakening to suffering, discontent, and the awakening itself is the way to see that suffering points to the awakened mind. Not by fixing it. Not, that's a worldly concern, sure. But the very fact that I can awaken to the feeling of feeling resentful, say, now this year I had a lot of resentment. I just had piles of resentment coming up. Old memories and like, that bastard. It's just old memories coming up, like from 10 years ago. Now, is that right or wrong? It's nothing. It's just karma. You know, some accumulated stuff from all the work I've done all of a sudden starts coming up. Is that a problem? Is that suffering? No, it's unpleasant. It becomes suffering. When does it become suffering? When I identify with it. But what if I take a different kind of experiment and identify with it, that this is in awareness? What if I do that experiment, that this feeling of resentment is in awareness? What if I choose that identity, this is in awareness, rather than the identity of thought, the identity of emotion, the identity of self and other, what if I do that? Well, you have to try it. And that experiment, you have to run it for 5 years. You can't just say, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, but that idiot, they did this to me and then they did that to me, then it's not the experiment. So to pick up an experiment or an exploration or something, you have to be curious. You have to be creative. You can't just follow some kind of rule book. You know, Buddhism, you do this, this, that, and the other. We tried all that, didn't we? I tried to, you know, do all the stuff they told me, but it wasn't alive. It was just some pattern that someone else said I had to follow. But to actually, like, take on the contemplation around the unconditioned, there's many ways to do that. And then to do that a lot, to do that, like this experiment, which I've been running for the past 6 months. So I'm listening to the chanting here. And then is this perception that chanting is in awareness. So then I was feeling my hands. It was Anjali, heat is in awareness. And then the sound. Now I can say, is there any essential difference to the sound which seems outside and to the hands which seems in my body? I could see no difference. It's just an object. It's just two objects. Now that, is that practice or is that inquiry, experimenting? What happens if you do that? What happens if you actually try that? Well, for me, the experiment, it keeps bringing me to peace, to non-grasping, to emptiness, to silence. Now, if I just do it once, oh, that's cool. Okay, what's next? And to sustain an experiment in this more subtle way requires a kind of... I think what it requires is an interest in the unconditioned. Now the world is just interested in the conditions, in the emotions, in analyzing the emotions, in job situations, in physical health, in building furniture, you know, all those kind of things that we do as human beings. And so the attention, as Lompo was saying this morning, or it's always out. Now these reflections, suffering feels this way, is not an outer, it's an awakening, an opening. And from that you can see that the problem with, say like with the problem of resentments that just kind of came through me this year, that wasn't the problem, it was the desire not to have it. And then you see that the desire is always about the object, you start to say, oh, let go of the desire, it just feels rotten. Yeah, but no, it just feels this way. And choose space, choose consciousness, choose awareness. What happens if you do that? You need to keep doing that. Then your home ground is awareness, no longer the emotion, the content of the emotion, the content of your history, the self-definition of who you were and who you shouldn't have been, and they did this to me and they did that to me, in whatever way it is. But is that a practice, maybe? I don't know. For me, it doesn't feel like a practice. It's much more interesting. Much, much more interesting. Another way to do that kind of experiment, if you're interested in the unconditioned, so that you might ask yourself, are you? Or are you just interested in emotions and physical health and good relationships and ice cream cones? You're allowed, right? But really, all of it's all ice cream cones, isn't it? Physical relationships, emotions, they're all just ice cream cones of different flavors. Because they're objects, they're objects. What isn't an object? Well, another way you could do that is to go, like I was doing that also. I use these two a lot as my experiment. Feel the hands. Listen to the chanting. What's changing? What's unchanging? That's a question. What's unchanging? Now, if you try to find a thing which is unchanging, you're off in the objective world again, and you're not in peace. Now your mind doubts and it thinks. So was it really that? Was that unchanging? That's just thought. So how can you do that? You have to stop thinking. As I was saying the other morning, why do we reject silence? What is it? Why do we, like, some of us complain, oh, my mind just keeps thinking. Why do you reject silence? Why not listen to silence? What is it about you? Isn't that worthwhile inquiry? Rather than say, oh, my mind just keeps thinking all the time. I don't know how to stop my... That's thinking. That's just more thought. Why reject silence? What is it? What is it about this consciousness which is just so habitually addicted to thinking, analyzing, self-disparagement? What is it? And that's a question. Is that a practice or is that a question? To me, it's a question. I'm not demanding that you be silent, because that won't work either. And we tried that, haven't we? It's to suppress thought. I'm not going to think. And that's not it. That's not an inquiry. That's a kind of control. But an inquiry is, why do I reject silence? It's always there. It seems much nicer than the thinking mind. What? Why? So that kind of inquiry, right? Is that a practice? Maybe, yeah. Maybe it is. But you see, what happens to the mind when you ask that kind of question? It makes the mind bright, attentive, present, interested. And it in itself is the answer. This is the irony. We're being ironic, huh? The irony is that that's it. The question is the answer. This is where it gets very kind of woo-woo zen. Because when you awaken, like, what is it? This is, they do this in Korean Zen. They just, the Roshi just come up to you, what? And all of a sudden, your mind is empty, present. Try to answer it, what? Well, 64, E equals MC squared. More salad dressing, please. As long as the mind's caught in the objective world. So we're, you know, in Buddhist practice of going beyond suffering, it's very clever that way, because as soon as there's suffering, the desire mind wants to create a different objective world, which is necessary, yeah, physically necessary, but it's also a delusion. Now, if you have a sense that there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn, that there is a dimension which the Buddha is talking about, then you must get to the place where it cannot be an object. If, however, your whole structure of spiritual endeavor is trying to get your emotions right, then good luck. It's a loser's game. It really is. Now, that I'm not advocating just we all be more and more creepy, but actually by witnessing, like say, I witnessed a lot of this resentment coming up. And didn't try to be a nice guy and fix it and do all kinds of practices around it. Well, I could understand historically where it came from. I just witnessed it. And the result is freedom. Both in the doing and in the cleansing. Both offer freedom. The cleansing is just kamma. Trust in Dhamma, leave the rest of kamma, right? Have you made the t-shirt yet? Yeah? Have you? You've done that one. He said he would make one like that. But you know, we do have to face karma. You know, we have memories, and you know, we've been ripped off by people, and we've done stupid things ourselves. So that, you know, the mind creates all kinds of memories, and they come through us. At times we'll be, wait, I've been at it for 45 years. What's the deal? Who said? I didn't sign up and say, you know, at year 45 there'll be nothing. There's nothing in the contract which says that. There is, but it's like that. And is that really a problem? If I thought that as a monk, 45 years, I should feel no resentments and feel actually in touch with all beings in a divinely sensitive way, yeah, I'd have a problem. But if I see that this is in awareness, this experience of resentment is in awareness that it's not mine. I'm not taking the identity of emotion as me. I'm taking the identity of awareness. Not as me, but as a way of speaking. So, what happens if you did that for a year? What if you made an experiment that you chose your identity to be awareness rather than the emotional content of your mind? What would happen? Write me a letter. Send me an email. But you have to do it for a year to figure it out, if it makes any sense. I suggest it's very powerful. Or the other. What is unchanging right now? You can't answer that with a, you can say something, but you can only, Ajahn Sumedho's intuitive awareness. Where it has to go, right? Mind becomes silent. Why do we reject that? Why do we reject silence? That's another question. You have to look into yourself. So the path is there. The teachings are very beautiful. So with this example of resentment, what happened is the desire was what was important, not the resentment. That's just content. That's just karma. But the desire not to have it, not to have that feeling, that was the problem. And as he just witnessed, desire as an object, desire as an object rather than being the subject of desire, it ceases. And all the time, the reference is awareness is your real home, rather than the moods or the objects or the desires around that. This takes patience, it takes trust, it takes faith. What do you have faith in? What do you trust? Do you trust your emotions? Do you trust the verbal forms of me and mine? The storylines, the narratives, the opinions, the views? Is that really, really trustworthy? The positions that we take as human beings? Not that they're right or wrong. But what's really trustworthy is the awareness of change, awareness itself. So we, as disciples of Lompo Cha, of the Buddha, of Lompo Sumedho, we're very, very fortunate, aren't we? To hear, like your question was really beautiful. You know, that we live in a time where it seems so crazy, and yet we have so much sanity here. Kind of sanity to be well with each other, care for each other, feed each other, encourage each other. Isn't that wonderful? Absolutely wonderful. So why do we suffer? So I could say to you, you should be grateful. Probably say that to yourself too. You should be grateful, right? You shouldn't suffer because this is a perfect place. It's another delusion. It's another sense of self. But to know discontent as an object, oh, discontent's this way, and constantly, yeah, but that's in awareness. Discontent's moving, what's unmoving? If you make that the reference, you begin to abide in the silence of the mind, quite naturally. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.